Hospitals. My name is John Richardson. I am chairman of LARA. My colleague is Alan Kind, who is our planning officer.
I've got the button.
Yeah, he's got the gun.
I'm going to do the technological.
Go on then.
Right, ready.
Good, it worked. LARA was formed in 1986 as an umbrella organisation for motorsport, as recommended by Professor Martin Elson's report to the Sports Council, titled Providing for Motorsport, the Image and Reality. Motorsport took that advice and created the motoring organisations Land Access and Recreation Association, which is LARA. For 30 years, LARA has acted as a unified voice to national and local government, national parks and highway authorities, and promoted responsible motorsport and recreation in these increasingly restrictive times. LARA acts as a national forum for the principal groups in countryside motorsport and recreation. LARA does not organise events, nor act as any sort of governing body, but assists members in a wide range of land access issues, policy and practice. LARA membership are organisations, not individuals, and includes all the UK motorsport governing bodies, the RAC Motorsport Association, the Autocycle Union, and the AMCA, the latter two being two-wheeled motorsport, the MSA, four-wheeled sport. Also both the Vintage Sports Car Club and the Vintage Motorcycle Clubs, together with a wide variety of other recreational organisations, including many of the MSA's regional associations. Currently, LARA has 24 members organisations, and these are detailed on our byway code, which is part of the handout that you'll get later on. These total over 750,000 active participants in total. Next, thank you. LARA members promote and condone lawful, safe and responsible activities controlled and regulated in sympathetic and considerate use of the countryside. LARA advises members on issues affecting their sport or recreation, including those which might otherwise have been overlooked. LARA provides a channel of communication with outside agencies, either directly or via a member. LARA individuals do have membership of local access forums, and LARA does encourage such activity. LARA works through consensus among its members. LARA represents a legitimate user group in the countryside, and whilst maintaining contact with LAFs, is aware of user group needs. LARA is a single point of contact for LAFs in the need to advise. LARA have produced a range of publications and documents available on our website which can assist LAF members understand complex issues. LARA are grateful for the opportunity to meet with you today and thank you all for listening. I'm now going to hand over to Alan, who will go through some of the current issues which are of concern to all of us. Thank you.
I'm doing this the old-fashioned way. What we've done, we've got obviously the questions for the workshop, but I've got a scene setting paper to come up to the questions to explain why we want to ask you these particular things. And if you'll forgive me, I'm going to read it, because that way I'll stick within the timetable. If I start doing it just from notes, I tend to wander off and take three times as long. I know, I've been told many times. So the topic for this workshop is recreational vehicles, and that is wide, but the context intended must surely be recreational vehicles in the countryside, use, abuse and solutions. And that is certainly a current and important matter. And the Countryside Minister, Rory Stewart, the Minister for Floods as well, as you might have seen him on the television, has recently, on the 11th of February, written to all the national park authorities about it. The public's driving of motor vehicles on unsealed public roads for recreation is not new, although some claim that it is. That some people see this activity as a problem is not new either, and that problem, be it perceived or real, is older than probably everybody in this room. Over the years, the problem flares and fades, changes and moves as regulations have been introduced and the social structure and attitudes evolve over time. The two issue trigger for the formation of LARA 30 years ago this year was an upsurge in negative media coverage for 4x4 driving, and also the attempt by some ramblers to disrupt car rallying in Wales. 4x4s remain contentious, in places at least, while rallying seems to have settled down to be seen as a valuable part of the local rural economy. LARA has always had an ethos of telling it how it is. We square up to what we see as biased and distorted criticism, and we do not shy away from telling our own people what are sometimes hard truths about what they do. How effective we are at getting our message across is, like most things, debatable. And that is behind the questions we are asking you to discuss and help us with today. A lot has changed in LARA's 30 years of operation. When I look at some of our early materials, they seem now so unsophisticated and basic in form, but the message has been pretty consistent that lawful driving on unsealed roads demands respect for other users and for the environment, and that unlawful cowboy use of unsealed roads, public paths and open spaces, is a constant but fluctuating problem, mostly resistant to enforcement and requiring but not getting alternative provision. What has changed since 1986? Three main areas, I think, have shifted around us. Firstly, we've had the sequence of countryside legislation. We've had the Wildlife and Countryside Act 1981, which facilitated the recording of what people call lost byways. Then we had the Countryside and Rights of Way Act 2000, which introduced the 2026 cut-off date, sparking a flurry of definitive map modification order applications, those provoking a fear of a deluge, which was the then minister's word, of byway applications. And that led, in turn, to the Natural Environment and Rural Communities Act 2006, which imposed a sudden and rather arbitrary extinguishment of unrecorded public vehicular rights of way. Now we have the Deregulation Act 2015, which has rights-of-way provisions but little directly affecting byways, primarily the gating of byways and restricted byways, but where the opponents of our activities use the bill, the deregulation bill, stages to launch a campaign for a total or, in the national parks, end to public driving on unsealed roads. And that drew from the then minister the promise of a review, what people called the Motoring Stakeholder Working Group. And that has led to the minister's letter on the 11th of February that I mentioned before. So the NERC Act of 2006 has caused to some degree a migration and concentration of recreational motoring off the routes that were lost onto the surviving routes. And the Act also provided a power for national park authorities to make traffic orders on unsealed roads. And that power has been exercised in places. Secondly, since 2006 or thereabouts, we've seen an increase in extreme weather events and a change in the predictability of when the ground is likely to be dry. If you go back 20 years, you could reasonably say the ground was going to be pretty dry from May through to the end of September. It's not the case anymore. In and after extreme wet weather, the vulnerability of unsealed roads to traffic impact rises considerably. LARA has proposed to the government a simple way of amending the existing traffic regulation provisions to allow rapid and formality-free temporary traffic controls, but the Department for Transport is just not interested. So what do you do? Thirdly, over the last 3 or 4 years, the cuts in local authority finances have hit highways and rights-of-way budgets hard and ever harder. For some councils, simply keeping even minor blacktop roads in good repair is now beyond their abilities. Successive hard winters broke the surface and caused heave, and the shoulders get crumbled by the ever bigger 4x4s that locals choose to drive as everyday cars. A stitch in time truly saves nine, but if you cannot afford the stitch, then you probably can't afford the inevitable nine either. Against this backdrop of changing climate, legislation and local government abilities comes the era of social media, where it seems that the traditional club structure, with its ownership, or at least control, of information, has been evolved into history. People are still driving on unsealed roads across England and Wales. Most, we think, drive responsibly, but some plainly do not. Groups of motorcyclists and some 4x4s are once again going out intentionally to drive anywhere without a care. They're driving on bridleways, they're driving on common land. There's nobody out there to stop them. There are few, if any, police to feel their collars. So what are you going to do? Ban them? They're already unlawful. You can help us reach out to exert peer pressure and influence, but if some of you, in quotes, are actively campaigning to take away our legal rights, why should we bother with what is as much your problem as it is ours? But we do bother, and we want to bother better, which brings us to the issues for this workshop to discuss. So we'll have just a short break. John, if you please hand those papers out. You have that, the text of what I've just said in there. And then if you'd find the page afterwards, please, which has three questions set out, or three issues set out. Do we have a note taker, please?
I'll take notes.
Excellent. Thank you. Do you want people to identify themselves when they raise issues?
Yeah, that'd be helpful.
Okay. This paper will ultimately be available as a PDF, so if you do want copies to pass on within your LAFs or elsewhere, one way or the other, we can make sure you get them. Whether it's through the papers for this conference or you just contact us directly, because the contact is in there somewhere, I hope. Be on the code of conduct, clip to the back if it's nowhere else. Yes, on the byway code. Okay then, we've got plenty of time. So this is the discussion topic. Since LARA started in the summer of 1986, one of its primary purposes and areas of work has been outreach to the people who drive motorcycles and 4x4s, who are not members of any club or clubs within the LARA umbrella, and whose behaviour is in the spectrum from thoughtless through antisocial to occasionally criminal. LARA has organised and participated in conferences and workshops. We've published, printed and circulated a code of conduct, which we now call the Byway Code, and you've got the latest version clipped to this set of papers. And we've tried to project an ethos of responsibility and sustainability. When we started, information was essentially the printed word. When I started 30 years ago, I had an Amstrad 8256, which operated a floppy disk that was about that big. You know, that's where we were at. And that, believe me, that was cutting edge. Most people were still on typewriters. Then information migrated to websites, and we could handle that. Now information is pushed out. Websites, you go and get information. Now information is pushed out to you and sought through social media. These are the questions then that we pose to you today. So firstly, what experience do you have of harnessing social media to engage with people outside the conventional club structure? Shall we throw it open, John?
Yes, absolutely. Anybody, please. Thank you.
Peter Redburn, Bramble Forest Labs. We live in an area where the vast majority of the land is owned by the Ministry of Defence. Now hit everybody, dog walkers, horse riders, and my particular is mountain biking. Although the army have vast tracts of land, they tend not to use a great deal of it a lot of the time. At other times, they use bits of it intensively. And there is, on Facebook, a large group of people who submit information on Facebook to what areas are currently being used by the army, advising other mountain bikers to stay away from those areas. And that works particularly well. Now, it's not a formal group, it's just people who expressed an interest in riding in the area. And that, to some to quite a considerable degree, has alleviated the problem of the army in the Aldershot Farnborough area.
And are they happy with the results of this?
The army never happy.
The army never happy, okay.
The army, basically, the army top brass say it's our land, everybody can keep off it.
Yes.
Which is unrealistic,
sure.
Given the population of the area and the paucity of land available for recreation. They have a particular dislike of mountain bikers and dog walkers, especially dog walkers who fail to clear up after their dogs, on the basis that their chaps are often crawling through the
Indeed.
Road.
Yeah.
I also put there so that mountain bikers cause problems because of their high intensity lights damaging their night vision goggles.
Yeah.
We've questioned this, of course, because if they're in theatre using night vision goggles, all it requires is for the enemy to shine a bright light, and it would seem that the army then become impotent.
Seems a reasonable comment.
Yeah. You're riding at night as well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some people have to go to work.
A couple of interesting points you raised. Right, one is about lights, that we have this problem. People are going out at night in Land Rovers with light bars on the top. And, people living in the countryside get very nervous about others out at 2 a.m. with Land Rovers with lights, or motorcyclists with head torches. So we do perceive that there is a problem. And I was told a couple of years ago by a Rights of Way officer at Cumbria County Council about the upsurge in mountain bikers going out at night. It seems to be like a new branch of the hobby.
But it's not that new. I was going out at night 30 years ago.
Yeah, but the head torches weren't as good.
I can talk to you about lights.
Yeah. Okay, but the other point, now this is maybe more relevant. A couple of weeks ago, John and I were in the Peak District talking to the officers at the National Park, because they have probably the biggest issues with motor vehicles there. And we were talking about this topic. This really is why this has crystallised as an issue for us now. And this officer said that the mountain bikers who sort of come out of Sheffield and use the National Park had been a problem. And they'd had rogues going where they shouldn't, people on footpaths, nature reserves, and they'd sorted it out themselves with social media. In other words, they'd used their own peer pressure to the point where they were now perceived as not being a real problem.
Sounds very much like the example you just gave about the military land.
Yeah.
They got together and decided where they could and could not go.
Gentlemen at the back.
Yeah. Yes, please.
You mentioned this peer pressure thing. I don't even know if you're in class at Somerset, but I used to work for recently. Two sides to the coin, if I can liken it like that. There's the good side, the bad side. The bad side is groups on Facebook that because they're using social media, and social media removes a lot of the conscience, the constraints, the morals that we have in our lives, it seems to be a little bit like going out to a pub and having too much to drink and getting all shouty with each other and not worrying about the consequences. You're getting larger groups who can get together much quicker to go out and do damage. But those larger groups are also found out a lot quicker. We've recently had a situation on the Salisbury Plain where a Barmer event has had to disallow all civilian vehicles, only allow military vehicles. It's gone from being a navigational rally to simply a military exercise. Solely because of pressure from Salisbury Plain training over the excessive use of the plane by every person who uses some form of mechanically propelled device when it's been excessively wet. But
But at that same time, we've also had more threats of conviction, more potential Section 59s than we've had in a long period of time, because Facebook, the good side of Facebook, picks up stuff very, very quickly, and there are a number of quite skilled users. Now, I know Glass has also had its issues with other organisations and with bad publicity on Facebook, and I do feel very strongly that if somebody is going to use social media to promote themselves or as a guide to do stuff, it needs to be managed well. It needs to be almost overmanaged, because it is very easy to slip into that dark side, if you like. And that's quite interesting, listening to the gentleman now about Mountain Bikers being able to actually hand out information quickly, and you mentioned how peer pressure can change. It's quite a fascinating subject. I'm surprised that a psychology student hasn't actually turned out an extra dissertation.
We are relatively new to Facebook, Lara, and we put out snippets of information which hopefully are beneficial to all. But we're treading that very, very carefully and very slowly to try to ensure the sorts of things you discuss don't happen. Thank you. There was a hand over here somewhere. No, just a bit further back, if I may. No? Okay, you're on. Please.
I have some experience of using Facebook as an administrator for two groups, not necessarily rights of way related. By the way, my name's Bobby Matula, I'm chairman of Worcestershire LAF, and I'm also the horse riding representative on the LAF. So I'm administrator for our local British Horse Society county branch, one of three administrators, and I use my powers there to update people about what's going on for BHS in access terms. So where we've harnessed County Council resources to repair bridleways, to let people know where there are temporary closures because of poor surfaces, badger holes, paths that they can't use for a period of time. And it's quite a powerful tool in terms of doing that. And it's also quite powerful in terms of recruiting people to your legitimate organisation, because there are a lot of riders out there who are not British Horse Society members,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Who see our output, because yes. The BHS group is a public group. Mm. They can see what events we're putting on, and they get access to the access-related information as well. And it's actually been quite a powerful recruitment tool. Mm. Encouraging more people to join the society, because they see what the society does for them in a very practical way.
That brings us on really to the second question. Can I do the second question and not leave your topic effectively, because it overlaps, because I've just got an eye on the clock. Okay, second question I've written is this. Has social media and the way in which it allows informal and ad hoc association of people with common interests eroded or even replaced organised clubs? If it has, who is going to fund the essential representational and legal work that most outdoor recreation organisations currently do? That's a bit of overlap, I think, there.
And you're suggesting just the opposite, in fact.
Well,
it's helped you.
I see social media as an add-on,
yes,
to what our traditional and formal club structure does. So we still have county committees, for example, in the British Horse Society, because the society does lots of different activities. It looks at welfare, not only access, it has several different hats in the horse environment.
Sure.
And I see social media as an add-on to what we do, that's about letting people know about things that are happening in their area. So it's there for people who maybe don't want to belong to the formal structure,
yeah,
who don't want to come along to a committee, but who do want to know what's going on and participate in events.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
The two can,
yeah,
coexist. And the one enhances the other.
Do you think then that, say, somebody might join the BHS because they can engage by social,
yes,
media,
yes,
as an alternative to having to go to a club night with a load of boring old people?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. That's very interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Chris Lake from Defra, I'm not sure I may be speaking, but tennis clubs, and there's some real comparisons here. And the last sentence of your second question piqued the interest of me about this belief that there's essential representation in legal work that's undertaken. And I wonder if there's a question that you're not addressing around that. Who thinks it's essential? Who's paying for it, i.e. members? Is it campaigning? Is it lobbying? Is it government asking you to do it? I think there's something there around, if there's no membership coming in because they're all using social media instead or informal forums, we've heard about mountain biking in particular, I think they're very good at using forums. Well then, where's the driver for this essential stuff you do? Which is obviously a concern.
Yeah. Right, well, look, if you take the Ramblers, the Open Spaces, the British Horse Society, the Trail Riders, Lara itself as examples, they've all been to court on a number of occasions over the last 20 years. Okay. So I think what you've got to say there is that the issues surrounding countryside access are there almost regardless of who is using or not using them. It's an issue that needs sorting out, whether it's two people using the path or 200,000 using the path. So if you're going to, if certain people think this is an issue that has to be pursued, you've got to fund it. And to fund it, you've got to have a certain number of people who are giving you a guaranteed income, or now I suppose crowdfunding, although that's a very tenuous method of funding things. To say, well, if people aren't bothered to join the club, the issue doesn't matter. I suppose that's true, but it's a... I don't know. But, all right, it's the way we've always done it. So if it's the way we've always done it, we've got to have a reason to change.
And our particular organisation, as I mentioned earlier, we don't have individual members. Our organisation comprises other organisations. So I don't think we would probably attract members directly.
No.
But some of our member organisation may. Yes, please.
Yeah, sorry to harp on about mountain biking, but I think I can draw a good parallel. Mountain biking has never had and still hasn't got anything like an effective national organisation.
Sure.
Yeah.
Therefore, it grew up, probably starting about 30 years ago,
yeah,
with local clubs.
Sorry, I thought CTC claimed.
The CTC.
Well, that's a lot older, isn't it? CTC's been around since the 25, I think, hasn't
it? Yeah, a CTC is a cycle touring club.
Yes.
And it's all right for people who want to go cycle touring.
Well, no, no, with all the
but their actual involvement in mountain biking is minimal.
Well, no,
UK.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's been a distinct swing away from a focus on the touring. To my regret, I have to say. But I think the portrayal there is not quite a correct one. Increased focus on cyclist rights and campaigning.
Can I fish it up?
Yes, please.
And so there's until perhaps in the last year, there has been no effective central body. So it's grown up around local clubs. But it is very, very noticeable that in the last 5 years, social media like Facebook has enabled people to organise themselves in non-club type, in social media club type organisations. And in debate with them, they feel that because they're organising on Facebook, they actually have no responsibility. Nobody, if anything goes wrong, there is no committee to take responsibility. You don't need a formal committee, you don't need a treasurer, because social media costs nothing. Certainly all the clubs in my area have either seen falling membership, in a couple of cases have disappeared altogether. Yeah. And it is social media that's driven that.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Yeah. One at the back, please. He's been waiting a long time, and then you, please.
I was going to say that actually last year, last
on Facebook and then have made a few mistakes, wandered around a little bit aimlessly in the internet world looking for hard, accurate advice and have come across Glass, had the help that they needed, and
yep.
then joined associate members.
Yep.
When it works very well, and
yes.
it can work very well.
Yep. I'm sure you're right. Thank you very much for that. Please.
Yeah, I was just going to say, sorry, it's Alison Kent from Exmoor Local Access Forum. I mean, I personally view social media as a good servant, but an extremely bad enemy, as a master on occasions. It can get very, very bitchy, bad-tempered, arrogant, all the things you really don't want to know about. And this happens in all social media, particularly on Facebook. This can happen, so I think it's something to be aware. You do need some form of control
yes.
to iron out these potential problems.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, we are almost virgins into Facebook. 12 months, maybe?
If that,
maybe,
we tickle the edges, that's all we've done.
We are conscious of that very thing, that what we do put on are factual items, be it to do with regulation or availability or legislation, without going off into the, well, how can I put it? Some of the less extreme or more extreme ways of contacting other people that do appear on Facebook. We're certainly aware of that, and we're guarding very strongly that we don't get into that, we hope.
Okay. You have to have somebody who sits there and says, I'm not having that comment, and that's a lot of time to invest, isn't it? Let me read the last question for you, John, because I'm conscious of the clock.
Yep.
We've answered some of this. The last part of the question, I think, is relevant. But I'd also say, bar all the young ladies here, think about the demographic of everybody in the room and the age group. That's the thing. Okay, question. Does social media operate a better outreach than do or did other media because it engages and empowers at little cost far more people than we could reach and influence previously? If it does, how do traditional organisations make the transition to using social media? That's our issue. Or does it remain as a bolt-on to traditional operating practices, as you said? And of course, there's a cost issue. Sometimes you can only do one or the other. You've got to, maybe we think we're getting to the point where we have to say, we're going down the social media route in the future, and printed codes of conduct might not even exist.
Yeah, the way we deal with it at the moment is one of our officers puts things on our Facebook only. He's the only person who does it. We might have a chat beforehand about should this go on or should something about that issue go on or that particular occurrence, but we leave it entirely to the one person in our organisation to put items on Facebook.
And I could add, what he puts on is actually usually a heads up to something that's on the website.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not the thing itself, it's a clue that the thing itself is something to go to the website for, which might not be using it right, compared to how some other people do it. But we don't know, really.
We've just issued a publication, actually, a few weeks ago. And there was a small item on our Facebook page announcing it. But the meat of it is on our website. You have to go to our website to read the document. More questions? We've got
5 minutes.
Another few minutes. Yeah. Yes, please.
I was going to say that if you're referring back to a website where no one can interfere with what you've written,
yeah.
The answer is to use Twitter, because then you can refer a single line text to your website rather than Facebook, because Facebook will get all sorts of responses on it. Whereas Twitter, a one-liner, like the National Parks use Twitter and other organisations, then you prefer, because the problem is the more you put on Facebook or other social medias, the more it gets diluted. You want to keep your information solid, which is on the website, which is correct.
Yes.
It's how people connect, such as
yes.
they use Facebook, they also use Twitter. Mm. A single line on Twitter comes up on people's alerts, and that's probably just as good to get rooted to your website than trying to put a Facebook entry on with all sorts of other bits and pieces on it.
That's very interesting. Okay, thank you. Could we ask, does anybody else here use Twitter? Right. No? Ah.
I don't, purely because if you're on lots and lots of platforms, you spend all the
Exactly.
You know.
We haven't taken that step yet.
Yeah.
We're still finding our way on Facebook, and so far we think we're doing all right.
I have a motto on my office wall. It says, "Computers eat your life." Which they do.
Yes, please.
Rights away, use Twitter to make comments about what work they've done. The rest of it. We as a LAF don't, only because we don't have a lot to say that would interest the general public. But it's something that we certainly could do, and I agree with Graham, that if you want your message to stay pristine, then that's a better way of going about it.
You laugh, people, and I'm one. I sit on two laughs, actually. Do any of you use Twitter? Any of your laughs? No, I wasn't aware that anyone did.
I'm not sure local authorities would.
They probably wouldn't like it. Yeah.
I don't think they would be able to resource it at the moment. Because we're down to our Worcestershire laugh, to our bare minimum of 2 meetings a year.
Yeah.
So nobody from the county council would resource.
I only ask the question because when Alan asks who uses Twitter, hands are end up all over the place, but clearly not laughs. Fine. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
It's something I will raise at the next forum, should we use it? Make a note of that now.
Okay.
As I say, I think it is one way of getting a message out.
Okay. Yes, please. That's a good question. Has anybody seen the Lara website? No? Okay.
Well, we all go home and look at it.
That's a lesson for us, isn't it?
Yeah, it is actually. Well, there's two lessons. Actually, one is that we're not reaching people with the Facebook page, and second is we haven't thought of Twitter, which might actually be a better alert system. There we go.
We're getting very close to the end to our allocated time.
Yep.
Is there one more question, please?
Has everybody got papers? Anybody come in late, not got a set? No.
Yes, please.
Another question is just a comment about using Twitter. Is that something I set up Natural England's one sort of 6 or 7 years ago when I was in the press office. I think we've now got sort of 45,000-50,000 followers. And that's often drawn in by controversial things we do, ironically enough.
Yes.
But, it does provide the opportunity for you to build a very specific and pointed audience, actually. We do our local one now, and we found, for example, somewhere like the Somerset Levels, the amount of local information that we get through that is remarkable. We'll get people telling us when ditch levels are 10 centimetres below agreed management plans, and it does find an audience, and it does organically. It's a really good way of sharing information about where there might be problems, actually.
Yeah.
So I would recommend it, and I would say institutionally probably not the way to do it. Although we do it here institutionally, more powerful is when you do it as an individual who has an interest.
Yeah.
And then you find you very quickly find your audience and your followers. Actually,
right.
I think you would probably find quite a big market out there for some of the information that you as LAFs and individuals hold to the knowledge that you have.
It's what you call propagation, isn't it? When information grows itself out of the mainstream of the information system. Interesting.
On the handouts that we've given you, the byway code is there. There is a pre-production run. If anybody sticks a hand up and said it's not valid till July this year, it is a pre-production run done specifically for these conferences. But on the back of that is our website, and you could have a look at that perhaps when you have a spare moment sat in front of your computers. Thank you all very much indeed for your contributions today. It's very good to be able to discuss these things with you. We're very grateful. Thank you.